Welcome to the Heartland Journal's Tennessee podcast with your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of heartlandjournal.com.
Howdy, I'm Steve Abramowitz, and this is the Heartland Journal's Tennessee podcast. Welcome back. If this is your first time, welcome. Tell your friends. We focus on the volunteer state and our nation today with always an interesting person making a positive change in our community. Welcome to HLJ's People in the News, where I interview people who are making an impact and are lovers of truth. Today, we are talking with special guest Michael Yaffe, not just in the news, reporter of news. Growing up in Orlando, Florida, Yaffe got his start in radio by graduating from the University of Central Florida with a degree in radio TV. Go Citronauts. With a dream of getting into talk radio, he began as an intern for Good Morning Orlando on News Radio WFLA Orlando in 2010 and was hired by the station later that same year. Soon after that, Yaffe worked his way up and became the executive producer and co-host of the show, along with hosting other shows like the Florida Roundtable, Beyond Reason Radio, and PM Orlando. Yaffe is always the voice of reason when it comes to news, politics, and culture, sounds familiar, and brought his Christian conservative voice to WVNN before WFLA Orlando. This was a sweet on his Facebook page. She wrote, "I am right now in the process of fulfilling my dream of being a conservative talk radio host." Married to Stephanie. You can catch him on the Yaffe program, 9 to 11 a.m. Central Time on WVNN in Huntsville. Yaffe Live, 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern Time on Talk Radio 102.3 in Chattanooga. News writer for yellowhammernews.com, Huntsville's and Chattanooga's voice of reason. Let's find out for ourselves. Hello, Michael. How are you today?
Good. Is that still on my Facebook page? I'm fulfilling my dream. I still up there, huh?
Still dreaming, this apparently. Yeah, nice. That's where I got it. You might want to change that and say living the dream. I don't know.
It's up to you. I guess so, yeah. How's it going?
Good. Are you in Huntsville or where are you?
I'm in Chattanooga right now, yeah.
Okay. How's the weather over there, that side of the state?
It was rainy for most of the day. Been pretty warm, but it's looking pretty nice now. It's cleared up a little bit, so that's good.
Okay, same here in Middle Tennessee. No rain, though. It took me a while to get used to the whole booking guests in Tennessee, but Eastern Tennessee has its own time zone, Eastern time zone. I'm in Central time.
I'm getting used to that as well, by the way.
So. Yeah, it's a big state, east to west. You know, there's three stars on the flag. Living on the Pacific time my whole life, but working on Wall Street time, I enjoyed the 2 extra hours of sleep, kind of.
Even
just the one day, getting used to it. I know it doesn't really work that way. So tell us, what made you love talk radio early as a young boy, little Mikey? What got you interested?
So it's kind of an interesting story. I mean, for one, I remember I was in high school working at Checkers and didn't work with the greatest people. You know, it's kind of a seedy environment sometimes. So I'd go to, on my break, I'd go in my car and listen to talk radio a little bit. So I got a little bit of that, but it really didn't start until college. Originally, I was going to go to college to be a pastor, but I kind of realized that I wanted to talk about more than my faith. I wanted to be able to talk about my faith, but also politics and also the country, patriotism, all that stuff. And I became a fan of talk radio, just listening in my car. You know, it used to be kind of like funny, ha-ha talk radio. And then I got into like news talk. Glenn Beck was one. I found him on CNN one day. He was speaking the truth. Then I got into listening to him. Then I would listen at work. I was working in an office at the time. And I thought, you know, this is a great way. There's such freedom in talk radio that you can talk about a bunch of different things. And it seemed like a great fit for me. So I applied for the radio television at UCF. And I thought, okay, if I get into this, that'll be kind of a sign that, oh, maybe this is what I should do. And I got into it. And, you know, God's just opened a lot of doors since then. It's been great.
Freedom. That's so 2010 of you. Would you tell little Mikey today to follow his dreams and go into conservative talk?
Yeah. So, I mean, little Mikey didn't really have those dreams. But, yeah, now, I mean, you're talking about once I got into it, especially in college, yeah, definitely. And you know, it's kind of funny because I remember I was getting really into news, politics stuff in college. And most of my college friends were not really into it. A lot of them are getting into it now because you get in your 30s, you have kids. But I do feel like a lot more young people are much more involved in politics. Like I go to CPAC now, and it used to be CPAC would be a bunch of old guys, you know, wonks or whatever. You go now and it's just like a lot of college kids, even younger, or very politically involved. And it's kind of interesting. It's kind of different. And I think there are good and bad things about that, which we can talk about, but it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's cool to be conservative again. Maybe Turning Point USA and Charlie Kirk had a hand in that. I'm not sure, because it certainly wasn't, the old Rush Limbaugh, who's no longer with us, or even Brinkley from way back when for this younger generation. But we'll talk about it. I mean, it's guys like you, basically. So how'd you keep your conservatism in this business? I mean, let's face it, when the money gets big, the Laura Ingrams, the Megyn Kellys, the Sean Hannitys, even the Tucker Carlsons of the world sometimes compromise those conservative values. They're not all Michael Savages or Rush to rise to enough fame to stay true. Many, if not most, are not good examples, in my opinion. How do you keep your conservatism?
Well, first I have to say, I am not that big. So maybe, a verdict is still out. If I get as big as a Rush Limbaugh or something, we'll have to see. I'm just the
little time to sell out. Is that what you're saying?
That actually is a really good question. I guess I just actually believe in it, and I believe in the future of the country, and it has a lot. I think it has mostly to do with my Christian faith. But I often tell people at UCF, I was a double major. So I was a religious studies major and a broadcast journalism major. And I tell people I should have ended up the biggest atheist liberal after that forever, but it really just challenged me. Other than that, I didn't really get into this for the money and fame aspect of it. So I think that's what kept me grounded. You know what I mean? There's some people, they do certain things like this because they want to be famous. That's not really my goal. Like, I want to be respected, well-known. I want to be successful. But I don't want to be famous just for the sake of being famous. That was not the primary concern. I felt I had a message and a voice of reason. And that's why I do this. All the other trappings that could come with fame or money, I'm a very simple guy with simple wants and needs, and I just don't really care about all that as much. So I think that's kind of what helps keep me grounded. I didn't get into this for those reasons. So,
oh, that's great. I sort of did it as a side hustle for a long time. I already kind of made my biggest pot of money, so to speak, so I could do this commercial free. Yep. Nobody could tell me what to say. I could write my own shows. I felt the liberation to be able to do something like that. For you to come up in the ranks of a corporation, and it's Cumulus, to be able to feel that freedom, that means you're with a good house and you're keeping your center that's grounded. So maybe Stephanie has something to say about that.
Oh, Stephanie, we can talk about how we met, by the way. It's kind of related to radio, me and
Go
Stephanie.
For it. Yeah,
tell but, us. We'll talk about that. But I do want to say, yeah, she helps a lot. There are definitely the temptations to sell out in different ways. When I started at WVNN in Huntsville, if I ever got any criticism, which, I mean, the audience is great, they love me, but there was always some that was kind of like, he's not MAGA enough. That was when Trump was still president, running again, everything else. And it's just like, there was just some, they're like, you're not right wing MAGA enough. And then, I kind of get to Chattanooga, and there's some other shows on this station that's very liberal, very left wing. And I come in and then I hear I'm too MAGA or something. So it's kind of, it's there are definitely pulls different ways where you think, oh, do I have to compromise? But, at the end of the day, it's just not worth it. They can see through it. You have to be true to yourself. And I think it goes back to, the Bible. You can get in the whole world and lose your soul. And, what does it matter? I would much rather have my soul than gain all these other things. So I want to be successful, but I don't want to be successful for the wrong reasons, I guess, if that makes sense.
It does. It absolutely does. I've watched enough of the other ones go the other direction to know the difference. And for the record, I don't get paid for this yet. So let's talk about your beat down there in Alabama, and you can interject, Stephanie, anytime you want. A lot of kids from my daughter's high school are heading to Auburn and Samford and Alabama in the fall from Middle Tennessee. So I'm fascinated. Republicans on the U.S. House Judiciary Committee are renewing a push that would see the FBI headquarters relocated to Huntsville. How do you feel about that?
The FBI headquarters relocating to Huntsville? I mean, I think it's good for jobs and everything. Other than that, are you saying should I be concerned politically or something? Or
No, you wrote about it on that Yellowhammer, so I thought maybe you had an opinion that you'd share.
Oh yeah. So I mean, most of my opinion has been I do worry about the Biden administration, playing politics, and they don't want certain things to go to Alabama. So that's really what I'm concerned about. And I think from what I understand, and that was something I wrote a while ago, and I think it was a news piece. But I think from what I understand, FBI coming to Huntsville, I think it would be a great idea because you have to get out of the swamp. I can understand why they wouldn't want it based in DC. So that's a, I don't think it's going to happen, unfortunately, but I think it would be a really good idea.
Yeah. Your Alabama Attorney General Steve Marshall is leading the effort against what he believes is an effort by environmentalists to control energy policy in this whole country. You don't want to allow states like Hawaii or California to define energy
Right.
policy for the entire country, he said. But they're using the threat of a massive jury verdict to be able to bankrupt the fossil fuel industry. So amen to that. I agree. You said, what are they doing to Alabama to force compliance, and how are y'all fighting back?
Well, I mean, a lot of it, frankly, is they're gonna have to fight in the court. So Attorney General Steve Marshall, by the way, is awesome. Big fan of his. If he would become the Attorney General of the country, someday, that would be awesome. Yeah, the problems with that is what happens is you have these federal court cases out of Hawaii or something where they mandate it, and then that affects the whole country. So for instance, when like California decides to do some of their EV mandates, well, it doesn't just affect California because the car makers are not going to make a different car for California than they are the rest of the country. So that kind of stuff is going to affect the entire country, which is why Steve Marshall and others, they're kind of fighting back, sort of in the interstate commerce clause that you can't just do this stuff on one in one state and not affect the rest of the country. And obviously we know that the Biden administration is very anti-fossil fuel, trying to push a lot of that green energy stuff, Green New Deal stuff. And it's just he's just trying to fight back in the courts. I think it's a good thing. I mean, he is always on the right thing, always on the right side when it comes to this stuff. Very rarely do I ever agree with our attorney general.
Yeah. Disagree, you mean?
Yeah, disagree. Yeah, did I say agree? Sorry. Yeah, very do I disagree? Yeah.
He also filed a lawsuit challenging the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission's new rule, which illegally expands the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, PWFA, of 2022. The PWFA was passed by a bipartisan Congress to require employers to provide common sense accommodations to ensure a healthy pregnancy and healthy baby. But the new rule implementing the WPFA forces employers, including the 17 coalition states, to facilitate employees' elective abortions. The 17-state coalition was led by attorney generals from Alabama, yours, as well as attorneys general from the following states: Tennessee, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Idaho, Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, North Dakota, Oklahoma, South Dakota, South Carolina, Utah, and West Virginia. There's your list of national divorce candidates right there. What do you make of where that is going?
It's interesting. You'll notice a theme here, and I think it's a good one for the future of the country. So obviously there are a lot of concerns with the future of the country on the federal level, especially when a Democrat's in office, but you have the administrative state, the regulatory state, all of those things that are just overbearing on the rest of the country and trying to mandate things that go against our values or not good for our economy. But the good news is the founders were pretty smart and created the federalist system in a way to kind of fight back against this. It's gonna have to be on the state level. So this is another one of those instances where you have a federal rule, a federal mandate trying to dictate to the states what they can do, and the states are fighting back. And this is also good as well because unfortunately we're a very divided country. And so a lot of ways to kind of have a sort of a release valve for some of that division is, okay, you can move to a state that better reflects your values. Unfortunately, that makes us divided state to state, but I think it would help a lot of our divisions and a lot of our political problems if a lot of this stuff was handled on the state level. Because right now we're so involved in national politics because there's so much at stake. Because the federal government does so much, it's just so much involved in our lives. So when that happens, you see all of these political divisions that just boil up into even into violence sometimes. And that's because there's just everything the federal government does now affects all of us. And there's got to be a better way to run a country. And I think doing things at the local level, more control at the local level, on the state level or the local level, is a way to get around that. So it would actually help some of our political divisions, but it also helps conservatives be able to fight back. One of the best examples of that is COVID as well, where conservative states were able to fight back against the giant power grab that we saw on the federal level from some of these agencies and then later the Biden administration. It just shows that, thank God for the power at the states. Could you imagine if the states didn't have that ability to fight back during COVID or any of these other so-called emergencies or whatever? If they didn't have the power to fight back, I mean, what would be our refuge at this point? So I think
we'd be the Soviet
that's
Union
kind of another.
before the breakup in 89. Yeah, it's command and control
Yeah.
never works. And the states are blessed to have a compact that says we could do this. Only Texas, as I'm aware of, could actually annex themselves and say, enough of this. We're out of here with our gold and our silver and our oil.
Yeah.
But the rest of us have to fight this fight like you're talking about. So I'm glad that the 17 of us are all on the same page. Remember Alabama Senator Katie Britt gave the rebuttal to the State of the Union. What did you think of her primetime debut?
First, I have to ask, what did you think? Did you have any thoughts on this?
I did not think she was ready for primetime, which is probably why it was late night, sort of like Saturday Night Live. And I first did think it was Saturday Night Live. Whoever wrote it and whoever framed it in her kitchen wasn't really paying attention to the mood of the country at the moment. It was a little too plain vanilla, and it probably needed to be much more forceful since we had just had Dark Brandon yell at us for almost
Oh,
hours.
I mean, her delivery was almost too forceful, though. I think that was kind of one of the problems. I will say this. One thing, you know, I actually know Katie Britt pretty well. I know her personally. I've seen her speak many times. That actually just is her. So a lot of people thought it was too performative. Like, it seemed like, oh man, she's like trying to act in like a high school play or something and just really trying to overact and chew the scenery. And it definitely came off that way. I'm not going to deny that. I mean, it really did. I mean, it was just like, it was a little bit too much, but that's her. So that's just how she is a lot of times. So in one sense, I agree with a lot of people. Like, this was not her best performance. I don't think Trump's going to pick her as VP now, mostly because of that, because we know Trump cares about that kind of thing. He cares about image. But, you know, what's interesting about it to me is like, okay, yeah, it's a little rough, but did you see the president's speech? Like, a lot of the people that were just in a rush to criticize Katie Britt over that response, it's like, okay, but it's still like 50 million times better than the president of the United States, who, and his State of the Union, which we should all care about. I mean, even when Saturday Night Live, like, they did their whole bit, it was like 2 seconds of kind of satire of Biden's speech and then 20 minutes of Katie Britt. And I'm like,
Perfect.
You know, this is the problem. It's the double standard. Like, I am fully willing to admit that that speech was not really that great. She came off as it was just too much. It was too much. But
at least she didn't, admit to shooting her puppy in the face or something like that. That would have been really worse. So Britt and Arkansas Tom Cotton sent a letter to Attorney General Merrick Garland and Secretary of Education Miguel Cardona, calling on them to shut down the riots currently taking place on several major universities across the country. You don't see the Columbia, Harvard, USC, UCLA, Berkeley, UW stuff much in the South, anywhere south of Vanderbilt, really.
Right.
Georgia's Emory, a little. UT Austin had cops cracking down. What do you think of college kids in SEC states? What are they learning differently from their woke, liberal Ivy League folks that different, where they don't come out of class supporting Hamas and other Middle East terrorists?
Well, I mean, I do think there is just a completely different culture. I mean, we were just talking about how the solution's kind of at the state and local level. I mean, that's kind of another example where, you know, the respite from a lot of this craziness, a lot of the woke craziness or whatever it is, it's definitely happening at the state level. It's kind of another example. But I would warn people that, I mean, these, even in the South, these universities are pretty liberal. I mean, maybe they're not as bad as like Harvard or Yale or whatever, Columbia, but they're still pretty liberal. So I would be concerned about that. I think a lot of it is more, instead of what they're learning, I think it's more just they know the administrations aren't going to put up with it. And that, you know, that's kind of, so like one of the reasons why Columbia is so bad is because Columbia, they knew Columbia would put up with it. I mean, they're basically getting away with it. That's kind of the problem. And then once you don't set the ground rules in the beginning, it just spreads and it gets worse. And they, you know, now they're like trying to negotiate with them. It's like, no, don't negotiate with them. They're students. They're breaking the rules. They're also breaking the law. So it's time to arrest them and put them, you know, get them out of there, suspend them, expel them. And I think a lot of these groups. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it really is. I think a lot of these groups understand that in the South, you see University of Florida is a great example of what they put out. They're not going to put up with it. So I think it's more on that side than it is, you know, what they're learning is different. Although I think some of that is no doubt true.
Yeah. Although they have to take a certain someone to spend the night in tents, even if they're provided for. And like, unlike Warren from Massachusetts or Schumer from New York, Britt also introduced the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, which would require the U.S. Department of Education to consider the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, IHRA, working definition of anti-Semitism when enforcing federal anti-discrimination laws. Do you think Senator Britt has a future we should be paying closer attention to, like Marsha Blackburn?
Wait, you think she has a future that we should be paying more?
Do you think she has a future in national politics, or is she going to be, you know, a senator from Alabama for a while and then move on to something
else? Oh, I see. No, I think she definitely has a future. I mean, she's already high up in the RNC, you know, right away. I think, you know, the State of the Union response was definitely a setback for her a little bit. But I mean, she is very good at campaigning. She is very likable. And she's a young, energetic female. I mean, these are things that the RNC, that the Republican Party, that really works in national politics. And I'll tell you, it was interesting because I actually, in the primary in Alabama, I actually supported her opponent. I supported Mo Brooks. But Katie Britt was such a good campaigner. I mean, she really was. And what she would do is just make everyone, she would go to every event and make you feel like you were her best friend. I mean, she would talk with everyone. She will talk with media. She'll make it seem like, oh, you're like, we're like best buds now. We're like friends. And that's a good quality. And that can translate on the national level as well. So I think she's pretty smart, pretty politically astute. And I think she'll be around for a while.
That's the retail politics that Bill Clinton was so good at, that Kamala Harris, for example, is so bad at. So that would be good for especially on the Republican side as a female. Last thing on her. She tweeted some pretty strong words. Any non-citizen on U.S. soil who supports Hamas should be immediately deported, and any American educational institution authorizing, facilitating, or otherwise supporting pro-terrorism activities should lose every cent of federal funding and subsidization.
I know, it's a hard word to say.
Follow through on that with some kind of enforcement, and will Alabama Governor Kay Ivey try that?
I don't know about Governor Kay Ivey. I would hope so, but the problem with that is the Democrats are in control right now, and that, there's just no way something like that's going to pass in the Congress right now. It's kind of common sense, but unfortunately, when it comes to stuff like this, there are too many Republicans, even in the Senate, that are kind of weak on this. And, you know, Democrats control the Senate anyway, but the House is split, and it's something that I wish would get done. I think she's absolutely right, but unfortunately, it's not going to go anywhere.
Do you think at the state level, maybe Governor Ivey would? She signed the Sound of Freedom Act, making Alabama's anti-human trafficking law toughest in the nation.
Possibly. I mean, the session is almost over, so that's kind of the problem. The Alabama legislature is weird because there's sometimes where they come out and they're really, really conservative, really great, and then other times it's like they're kind of a little wishy-washy. Legal immigration is kind of one of them, and that's because you know, the Chamber of Commerce, the Farmers Federation, all that, they have a lot of influence here, and they want that cheap labor. So when it comes to like illegal immigration or something like that, it's, you know, it's kind of a problem.
Tennessee and Alabama have that disease in common. Former coach, U.S. Senator Tommy Tuberville, Republican from Auburn, believes
Tuberville.
Tuberville, Tuberville, right?
I got it wrong too when I first got to Alabama. Don't worry.
He likes Tuberville. Okay, well, I'm not in Alabama, so I can get it wrong and be okay. I'm a Vol guy now, but anyway, believes President Joe Biden's energy policies are hurting America's national security. How are they doing that? And is Tuberville a conservative fighter?
Oh, he's definitely a conservative fighter. Now, when it comes to the national energy policies, I mean, let me give you an example. I think it's one that Tuberville brought up. We are banning liquefied natural gas exports. Why in the world would we do that? I mean, if Russia is one of our adversaries right now, we should be supplying the world with as much natural gas or any other energy that we need to do. We were the arsenal of democracy in World War II. If we're really going to stand up to Russia, we need to be the energy producer of democracy. So it's good for our energy market here, but it's also a national security issue. When you're doing stuff like that, we're constantly going to be dependent on other countries. Or, our military is dependent on this. The strategic oil reserve is not where it should be. I mean, all of these things play a role in our economy, but also play a role in our international security. And of course, when our economy is weaker, that also plays a role in our national security. So those things are related. And when we have this constant Green New Deal agenda that is just constantly fighting the production of more fossil fuels, more energy production in this country, it's going to affect every part of this country because fossil fuels affects every part of this country, every part of our economy, national security, our military. And we can pretend that we can replace all that with solar panels and windmills. We can't. I mean, it's just impossible. It's not going to happen. So
No,
we
and
need
they
to produce
freeze in
as
the
much.
winter, so we learned that lesson from Texas.
Exactly,
And
exactly.
he also seems to be kind of a stalwart there on the ramparts. He was holding up a lot of Defense Department nominations, and the press came out swinging about him weakening our defense preparedness. Did you follow that? And was he right to keep these Biden appointees out, or was he waiting for a progressive deal to help himself, like the news said?
Oh no, he was exactly right. So I was one of the, there were a lot of Republicans who did not like him doing that because it was a military thing. And they said, well, we agree with you because it was all over an abortion policy. So basically, the Biden administration against the Hyde Amendment was going around and paying for people in the military to travel to get an abortion. Directly against the Hyde Amendment, should be against the law, but nothing was being done about it. So Tuberville, his power in the Senate, one power he has is to place these holds. So that's what he did. And instead of the Republican Party maybe uniting behind him, they kind of stabbed him in the back. Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, others. If they would have united behind him, it could have been a really strong message. And so eventually he just could not get support from his party members. But I think he was right because notice we're not talking about that anymore. It is not, that was a huge national story about how they're paying for travel for abortions in the military. And I said, as soon as Tuberville caves, or as soon as Republicans cave, the issue is going to be gone, but the abortions are still going to be taking place. It's exactly what's going on. We're not even talking about it anymore. So it's one of those issues where I wished Republicans would have united behind him, especially because Republicans are trying to find a message on abortion right now. They're kind of losing the messaging battle since Roe v. Wade has been overturned. And Trump's out there saying, well, just on the state level, we'll do that. And I'm like, look, there's one issue where Republicans can unite behind a message on abortion, and that's saying no taxpayer funds whatsoever for abortions. I mean, all Republicans can agree with that. This was a way to put forward that message. But unfortunately, Republican Party, they caved to the mainstream media, and it just, he couldn't do it alone.
And following on the heels of that, we got a relatively somewhat conservative-minded, faithful Christian Speaker of the House from Louisiana who've decided to fully fund abortions in the federal budget. So something bad happened right after that. It was almost as if those ramparts did fall. I know I'm going to get emails if I forget to ask you this. So tell us how you met your wife.
So yeah, it's a funny story. She was a fan of mine in Orlando. I would do my show Beyond Reason. It was a show I just do once in a while when they let me, and she listened, but she didn't contact me or anything. She just followed me on social media. Well, it was shortly after that where I was on one of the dating sites, Bumble, where the girls, and I saw her picture, and I was like, this picture looks familiar. I know I've seen this picture. And I remembered it was social media. And then I looked and I actually looked into the profile. I was like, oh, she's kind of cute. So I was like, hey, do we know each other? If we do, I'm really sorry. And she goes, no. I've just heard you on the radio and follow you on social media. Then we met for coffee. And then, the rest is history. So
You ever see Play Misty for Me?
You say what?
You ever see the movie Play Misty for Me with Clint Eastwood?
Oh no, I have not. I have not. Is
Well,
that
I'll check
kind of
it
what
out.
happens?
Well, you check it out on Netflix or something. It goes the wrong way, but anyway.
Well, I will say it's what's even crazier than this. And my pastor told me this, told us the story at the wedding. But so her Steffi's dad, I never got to meet him. He died a couple years before we met.
I'm sorry.
But he used to listen to the morning show that I was producing. So he knew who I was. And apparently I was joking one morning on the morning show that her dad, I guess, told her that she can marry Tim Tebow one day or something. Like that was the joke. Like you'd be like, oh, one person I can give you my blessing for is Tim Tebow if you want to get married. Apparently, he had heard me on the radio a few times and said to Steffi's mom, before we ever met or knew each other, that, Steffi could marry that Michael Yaffe. And he basically gave me his blessing before we ever met, even though I've never met him. So it's
Oh,
kind of
that's
like one of
amazing.
those Christian, it's one of those God things where it's like, in a way, I was able to get her father's blessing, even though I never met him. And that was even before we met. So it's just kind of, Steffi didn't even know that. We found that out later from her mom. But that
Oh,
was just a crazy story I
that's a
could
cool
not
story.
believe.
One for the grandkids for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
What is Yellowhammer and yellowhammernews.com?
So yellowhammernews.com, it's kind of a news conservative news blog site in Alabama. Focus on Alabama. I really focus on Alabama politics, so I do a lot of the news writing, but I also write some opinion pieces for them as well. So they've been letting me do that. So I think my latest one was on Katie Britt's message on abortion, which I think she's right on. So you can check that out, yellowhammernews.com. I'm always writing stuff. I was writing stuff right before I got on with you, actually. So,
Okay. That's YAFFEE. Okay.
yes.
A little bit more about Alabama, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So Alabama's Congressional District 2's election is once again gaining national attention. Reuters highlighted the contest as one of 11 House races to watch. The district was redrawn last year after a three-judge panel made its selection from maps proposed by an appointed special master. This came after a ruling stating that the maps authorized by the Alabama legislature did not meet the standards of the Voting Rights Act. District 2 will now have a 48.7% black voting age population, causing many to believe that a Democrat will most likely win that congressional seat. Shamari Figures, a Democratic former Justice Department official and first-time candidate, Caroline Dobson, a Republican, emerged from an April 16th runoff primary. The district was created after a federal court order. Wow. Alabama to implement a congressional map that created a second largely black district. That decision is expected to give Democrats a rare opportunity to gain a seat in a conservative southern state. Caroline Dobson was able to gain the Republican nomination after defeating former state Senator Dick Brubaker, Republican Pike Road, while Shamari Figures was able to gain the Democratic nomination after defeating state rep Anthony Daniels, Democrat Huntsville. According to a poll conducted earlier this month, Figures had a slight edge with a 45% of the vote to Dobson's 44%. Uh-oh, right for cheating, with 10% undecided. So elections are supposed to be run by the state. We see right here, feds messing with states on who they send to DC. You wrote about that in Yellowhammer. What's your take on this race in Alabama?
So this race is very interesting. It's getting national attention because they want to send another Democrat to Alabama from Alabama to Congress. So right now there's one. It's Terry Sewell. She's out of the Birmingham area, and there was this whole issue where they had a they you know the state does redistricting, and the state put out their map, and the map. It was pretty similar to what they've done in the past, but all of a sudden there was a lawsuit and said, nope, this map is racist. Because it doesn't have, you have all of the minority vote in this one district and not enough here. So, they claim they used the courts to make it racial gerrymandering. Alabama fought back. It's a long story. They lost that fight. But I think all of that was about trying to get another Democrat seat out of Alabama. You can claim it's about race or whatever, but it was really about trying to get another Democrat seat. So you have this District 2 now, which used to be the way it was drawn, heavily Republican. Well, now it's like thinking it's going to go another Democrat. But what they had to do is the other district, Terry Sewell's district, they had to make that less African-American to make this one more. So it's possible that you can have Republicans win all the seats because it's so close in each of those things. And looking at this race, you know, when I've talked to people about it, they've been pretty pessimistic, thinking, oh, it's no, a Democrat's going to win. But you look at that poll and you look at Caroline Dobson, what she did in the Republican primary, there's some optimism that maybe a Republican can actually win this seat after all, which would be hilarious because the whole point of it in the beginning was to have a Democrat win. So
that'd be great and pump it up by R plus one. Tennessee just got union at GM in Chattanooga. The left is very happy about that here in Tennessee. It looks like Christmas came early on their Twitter pages. Unions have been in decline for decades until last year when Biden saw huge increases in membership. Arthur Orr, concerned Alabama auto manufacturing could come to a screeching halt if UAW is successful. State Senator Orr, Republican Decatur, is worried about the future of automobile manufacturing in Alabama because of the effort to unionize a Mercedes-Benz factory. What's your take on this? Good for Mexico and bad for Tennessee and Alabama?
Amen. That's basically what it is. You said it exactly right. So, yeah, the unionization effort, a couple of different aspects to this. Now, I guess you could argue that maybe these automakers are not taking care of their employees as much as they should be, but I think that plays a minor role here. I think, one, the card check system gives union an advantage, and there are federal laws that give unions an advantage here. We saw in Chattanooga where, yes, it did unionize. And the problem with the unionization is, okay, in the short run, you might get some benefits, but in the long run, your wage might be zero because the plant could close down and move. And we all know this because it happened in Detroit. It's happened other places in the past. And the big three automakers almost went out of business. Two of them had to be bailed out by the federal government. So I'm thinking the problem with these unions, I think, is they're not really just about, oh, we'll get better benefits for our employees, you know, and be fine. I think a lot of them are radicals. You know, when you talk to union organizers and union bosses, Sean Fain, who's the union boss here now with the UAW, he said he doesn't believe billionaires should exist. So when someone says that, I'm like, okay, this is not just about, oh, trying to help your employees do a little bit better. This is about wanting to radically transform the economy to more of a socialistic mindset. And unions are collectivist by nature, because once you're a part of the union, you're no longer an individual. You are part of that collective. You are negotiated as part of that collective. And I think that's not good for the overall economy. And then they're like trying to fight for a 32-hour work week recently. I see stuff like that and I'm like, okay, this is no longer about just trying to make a better life, a better pay for employees. You want to radically transform the country. You want to radically transform the economy. And the end result is you're going to destroy the golden goose that has helped Alabama be the number one export of automobiles in the country right now. But a lot of it too is they just have a, you know, the average worker just, you know, they buy into the hype, they buy into the arguments. So they're like, okay, I want to be a union. But overall, it's like a misunderstanding of the economy. You know, yeah, once the union,
after the late 1800s, early 1900s, and they got the little kids out of the coal mines and such, I think all they really did was benefit the bosses who had very gold-plated healthcare, high retirement accounts, big pension plans. The day workers usually end up, like you said, losing everything in the name of gaining something. For the sake of time, I'm going to move on a little bit. Alabama head coach Kalen DeBoer announced Wednesday that he has retained and promoted both Freddie Roach and Robert Gillespie for his Crimson Tide coaching staff. DeBoer was the head football coach at the University of Sioux Falls from 2005 to 2009, Fresno State from 20 to 21, and the dreadful, up until last year, one-hit wonders, University of Washington, where I'm from, didn't go there, but I'm from there, from 2022 to 2023. Nick Saban is like the Mount Rushmore of college football newest inductee. He's like the George Washington to maybe Callen's John Adams in the long shadow. What do you take on future of Alabama football?
I mean, I think they'll be okay, but I have to be honest, I am not an expert at this subject. So
you kind of had to be in Alabama. It's like,
you would think as soon as I moved to Alabama. So I moved there about almost 4 years ago to Alabama originally. And yeah, people always, well, you have to pick Auburn or Alabama. So you have to do, I'm a UCF fan. So I went to the University of Central Florida. And Alabama football fans don't like me too much because it was UCF, I think in 2014, 2015, that said they were national champions because they went undefeated that season. I don't know if you
Right.
remember that.
I do,
Alabama was the, you know, the winner of the national championship that year. So they don't like me too much. But when it comes to Alabama football, I mean, I know a little bit, but I mean, one thing I can tell you is that Alabama fans, they'll act very pessimistic because Nick Saban's gone, but they do that every year because they expect to just win national championships every year. They're just that spoiled at this point. Do I think it's going to happen again? I don't know, but I mean, they're going to be fine. I mean, it's still a big school. They're still going to have a good recruiting class. I mean, they'll be fine.
If anything, it'll just give them a pause. And like I said, I have a freshman at
Right.
Auburn and I want them to have a good run against them. So better odds now than if Saban was still there.
Yeah.
We'll take it. Okay. One of my girls' high school reading list books was Just Mercy by Bryan Stevenson. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but I'll just tell you. Number one New York Times bestseller back in 2014. They made a movie about it 2019 with Michael B. Jordan from the Creed Rocky movies. World-renowned civil rights defense attorney Bryan Stevenson works to free a wrongfully condemned death row prisoner. You know, of course, To Kill a Mockingbird, 1962, Gregory Peck movie, same thing. Both shine the light on Alabama and race. What do you think the state of race relationships are in Alabama? To Kill a Mockingbird, Jim Crow, still which lead to, you know, Birmingham, Rosa Parks, Montgomery bus boycott, 1955, center of the civil rights movement, or much improved and more tolerant now?
I mean, I think if anyone looks at their reality objectively, they would have to marvel actually at how much progress has been made, not just in Alabama, but across the country when it comes to race. I mean, it is, yeah, someone who reads a lot of history and read what went on in Alabama in the South during those eras of Jim Crow and everything else, it's nowhere even close to that right now. And the reason why I say that is objectively, yes, but you look at some polls recently and it's not, you know, you both side, white or black, will say race relations are not as good as maybe they would say 20 years ago. And that to me is insane because obviously it is. So I think a lot of the division when it comes to race in this country, it's being fueled by social media. It's being fueled by the actual media. And it's really unfortunate because it's a perception over reality. It's kind of like, you know, what's going on in these college campuses. Those who are protesting pro-Hamas, they don't come to that conclusion on their own. They're taught that. They're indoctrinated into a belief of that. If you're just a normal person and you look at what Hamas did and you understand Israel has to fight for its existence, you're not going to start protesting for Hamas. So it's like, where does this idea come from? Well, they're taught it. They're taught it in schools. They're taught it by the media. They're taught it by pop culture. And I think in race relations, you know, there is a history there. So some are, you know, it's going to be hard to just, you can't erase the history. So you can't just expect it to be all better overnight. But I think a lot of it, frankly, is that we're taught in our culture to once again look at someone's race. You know, if you're a minority, you're taught, well, you're oppressed and white people are going to oppress you. So they have that attitude since they're young now, and then the opportunities don't come and they blame someone else. And it's like no, this is not the way to do it. We're a country based on individual rights and individual responsibility an individual character. And when we're constantly focused on our racial identity groups, or whatever our identity groups are, it goes against that. And I think it's unfortunate because anyone can really succeed in this country. But as I mentioned, if you just look objectively, there is no way. A lot of these so-called activists and whatever you want to call them, they'll act like, they'll say, it's like, man, it's like things haven't changed at all since the 60s. And it's like, that is objectively not true. There is just no way anyone who is just living a normal day believes that, actually thinks that. So it's a perception over a reality thing, unfortunately.
I think you're right. And I also think that Bear Bryant USC Alabama football game leading to integration really did have a huge, great, undervalued impact on America and the world. In 1846, Michigan became the first state to abolish the death penalty for all crimes. The death penalty has been abolished in 23 states. Seven states sentence people to death now: Alabama, Arizona, California, Florida, Louisiana, North Carolina, and Texas. Texas has been responsible for the most executions over recent years by far, with 586 since 1977, the year Elvis died. As of the end of 2023, don't mess with Texas, they say, for a reason. The states with the next highest totals are Oklahoma, 123 since 1977, Virginia, 113, Florida, 105, and Missouri, 97. Why am I telling you this? Alabama Governor Kay Ivey sets execution date for death row inmate Keith Edmund Gavin. The state's window to execute Gavin starts at midnight July 18th and ends at 6 a.m. July 19th. The execution will be carried out by lethal injection. Gavin, now 63, was convicted of capital murder and sentenced to death in November 1999 for the March 1998 killing of William Clayton Jr., a driver for a courier company. The jury recommended the death penalty by a 10-2 vote. He was also on parole in Illinois at the time after serving 17 years on a 34-year murder conviction. Gavin is scheduled to be Alabama's third execution this year, following Kenneth Smith, who was executed by the state via nitrogen hypoxia January 25th, and Jamie Ray Mills, whose execution date is set for May 30th. How do you feel about Alabama's death penalty and the three death sentences in 2024?
I mean, I'm not someone who's against the death. I support the death penalty. I will say the problem with the death penalty nowadays is it takes 20 to 30 years, sometimes more, to actually carry it out. So if there is an argument against it, that's really it. It's just become a, you know, the whole point of the death penalty is it's supposed to be justice, yes, but it's also supposed to be a deterrent, you know, the ultimate deterrent, because they've committed the ultimate crime, taking you know, someone's life. And unfortunately, the deterrent aspect, I guess it's still there a little bit, but it's just not. When you're waiting 30, 40 years, it doesn't seem like justice at that point. It doesn't seem like a true deterrent. I mean, on a moral level, I have no problem with it. I just, the biggest problem I have is like, it's almost pointless now because it just takes so long, the process. And it's like that in a lot of things in our justice system. It's just, if we really wanted to deter crime, it's got to be faster.
Expedited. I agree with you. Yeah. You know, I mentioned that book, Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption, because it said in it, 80% of the death row inmates are there that are Black for killing a white person, even though in Alabama, 65% of homicide victims are Black. Do you find that to be true? More capital punishment for Black on white crimes, like Georgia, which is at 11 times more likely to get the death penalty if a Black killed a white man than if a victim was Black?
I mean, honestly, I'd have to look more into the stats. I honestly don't know any of that. I mean, when you look at the recent cases, all I can do is look at the individual death penalty cases, and they're usually very, very troubling, very, very heinous. So my response to that, if that is true, is it needs to be death penalty across the board. I mean, it needs to be just as much if you kill a Black person as for a white person. You know, some people might have the responses, well, that's why we should get rid of the death penalty. And it's like, no, I don't. It's kind of like when, you know, one of the discrepancies that used to exist in our drug laws is there were stricter penalties for crack versus cocaine, regular cocaine. And that's because it was often poor Blacks who did crack while it was rich white people who did cocaine. And some responses be, well, let's lessen the penalties for crack. And I'm thinking, no, let's increase the penalties for cocaine. That's the answer there. So if you're talking about justice, obviously I agree it should be equal across the board. In terms of the details you said, I have to admit, I don't know those details.
Yeah, and I got it from a book, so you have to take it with a grain of salt. But I agree with you, equal punishment under law and justice for all. Yeah. So what big stories are you working on now that we can keep an eye out for? And then I'll let you tell everybody where they can find you.
So, yeah, unfortunately, the Alabama legislature, we were talking about immigration in Alabama legislature earlier. They had their own Wake and Riley Act on the state level. Looks like it's not going to pass. It's ran out of time. So that's unfortunate. They're also looking at passing a bill that could allow illegal immigrants to go to college, which I understand they want kids of illegal to be able to go, but this creates more of a magnet. You know, until we secure the border, you don't want to create a magnet. So that's kind of something that's going on. You know, nationally, I've been just watching the college protests a lot. And I don't even like calling them protests. They're occupations. I mean, basically what they are, they're insurrectionists at this point. Yeah. They're just taking over the campus.
Vandals as of last night, breaking windows and occupying libraries. Yeah.
Yeah. So we've been keeping up with. Yeah, the only silver lining with the whole college protest is it It hurts the Democrats because the Democrats want everyone to focus on the Trump trial right now, which is not getting the attention he usually would because everyone's focused on these protests. I mean, CNN's trying to do wall to wall on the Trump trial, but you know, this kind of stuff, the only benefit is it helps Trump, hurts Biden in the long run, especially because Biden's been so weak on this.
And there's a lot of parents who are watching what's happening to the $60,000 to $100,000 a year that they're spending and saying, that's not a very good return on investment. I'll vote Republican. Okay, Michael, thank you for your time. We're at the end here. So tell everyone where they can go to find out more about you and follow your socials.
Yeah, follow me on X, formerly Twitter, at Yaffe, YAFFEE. You can like the Yaffe Facebook page as well, or Google the Yaffe Program Podcast to check the podcast anywhere podcasts are available.
Very cool. Hope to have you on again sometime. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Talking Alabama.
Yeah, talking Alabama.
All right, welcome to Steve and Steve's segment of our show. Producer Steve, what'd you think of our kind of a surprise guest, Mike Yaffe?
Well, that was nice. You have done a good job of connecting with a lot of other talk show hosts, and it's been well for you. I just want to segue into saying that I was talking to a 2 points. One, the real criminals, the people who've done a lot of damage, killed more people than one guy who got out of hand and is now sitting in death row, I think of Fauci. Do you think he'll ever be arrested and face the crimes of what he did? I don't think so. And we had Dinesh D'Souza, and he wrote a book, and he points out that the lowlifes get arrested, but the real lowlifes never see this side of prison. And that's where I see real injustice in our country. It's systemic within our government. And as far as the protesters and what's going on, I think just like all protests, there's paid actors out there that are literally doing this to create havoc. We saw this during the Black Lives Matter. We saw people that came in, Soros, you name it, were hired, they came in. We saw it on January 6th. There was hired actors that created what they created, and then it was an excuse to point fingers at these groups. And this happens all the time. These people have the right to protest. They see what's going on, Israel killing off all the Palestinians. They don't like it. No one's saying, I support Hamas, but what you get in the news is pro-Hamas, pro-Israel, blah, blah, blah. But the point is we've seen this for years, Steve, is all these groups, they go out, they protest peacefully. My church, we went out, just carried some pro-life flags last Sunday, and we didn't disturb anybody. But what if some Antifa people came in, jumped in, and started taking a flag and beating people with it? Then the next thing, Steve, our 250 people would be in the news saying we're just evil pro-lifers, blah, blah, blah. And so I think we have to be very careful because these people are not dumb, Steve. They take over and they start making it bad on everybody. And but that's just my point of view.
Okay, clip number one.
All right.
Happened again. Mail stolen from those USPS blue mailboxes, this time right in front of a post office in Newton. And we've heard of some instances of checks there being washed and altered.
Our Danae Bucci live in Newton with how the Postal Service is now responding. Danae.
That's right. Well, the U.S. Postal Service says they've actually received multiple complaints about mail getting stolen out of these mailboxes. And we spoke to one of the victims who says she had $10,000 stolen.
I'm one of the old-fashioned check writers, so I do mail checks often.
But the last time Deborah Gordon dropped off a check in this mailbox, it was stolen and washed.
Monday morning when I checked my bank statement, the check was cashed and altered to reflect a name, Cassidy Rodriguez. I had made the check to one of the government agencies.
The U.S. Postal Service says they've received multiple complaints of stolen mail from this location on Beacon Street in Newton. There's been a national rise in postal crime, and the USPS has expanded actions to protect employees and mail security.
Is that what you wanted to hear, Steve?
Yep. Audit finds serious problems at U.S. Postal Service facility. Just 66% of first-class mail at the facilities has been delivered within 2 days. That means one of three don't make it, for you liberals listening. The U.S. Postal Service Inspector General investigated the facility in Richmond, Virginia, after it was turned into a new regional processing and distribution center. The watchdog found several problems in its investigation. Quote, we witnessed idle terminal handling service staff waiting for mail, and in one instance, a mail handler sleeping on a parked forklift. We found a general inattention to detail that resulted in mail left on or around machines, large amounts of machinable mail in manual processing, and in one case, mail over 2 months old left in a container in the truck yard. We also observed clutter and congestion in many areas of the workroom floor and around the loading docks, the inspector general said as it reported the results of the audit on March 28th. The Postal Service has said the facility would save money in the long run, pegging the savings at $15 million a year by limiting some positions and reducing hours for others. However, according to the audit, no positions have been eliminated as of yet, and work hours have increased since the facility was converted in July 2023 into a regional center, despite a decrease in the volume of mail. Senators Mark Warner, Democrat Virginia, and Tim Kaine, Democrat Virginia, and Reps Jennifer McClellan, Democrat Virginia, Bobby Scott, Democrat Virginia, Rob Whitman, Republican Virginia, they have one, Abigail Spanberger, Democrat Virginia, Bob Goodlatte, Republican Virginia, oh, there's two, and Jen Kiggins, Republican Virginia, okay, three, said in a joint statement that it couldn't be clearer that USPS has not been providing reliable services to Virginians. This report pinpoints a number of issues, they said, adding that the Postal Service moving forward must provide more resources and clearer guidance to manage Mint and staff at the Richmond facility. Members had previously called on the Postal Service to address delays in the region after hundreds of colon cancer test samples were rendered unusable because it took too long to ship them. Dane Coleman, the Postal Service's vice president for processing and maintenance operations, said in a letter to the watchdog that the services would accept many of its recommendations, including the recording of all trips in its system and improved planning before returning facilities into the new regional centers. The Inspector General's office said that further investigations into the Richmond facility and other regional facilities are planned. It also noted some successful suspects of the first conversation, including the implementation of an upgraded workroom floor layout to improve mail flow and the installation of new decking to help workers load and unload faster. All you folks who think that mail-in ballot voting is a good idea, there you go. Clip number two, please.
Enemy number one. The entire world went from completely oblivious to their existence to a diehard opponent to them over the course of literally just a couple of years. Now, every single person watching this video knows exactly who BlackRock are. They know exactly what they do, and they know exactly why it's wrong. And this has created an existential crisis for BlackRock. They simply cannot survive as a business with such god-awful public relations because their business at the end of the day caters to normal, ordinary, hard-working people, the very same people who deeply resent everything BlackRock is. And luckily for us and unfortunately for BlackRock, things only seem to be getting worse for them. The time bomb is ticking. BlackRock's ESG scam has been well and truly exposed, and they know it now as well. Over the last couple of weeks, drastic developments have come to fruition, showing us just how late stage this party is, and BlackRock's collapse is truly well upon us right now.
BlackRock hit with cease and desist order over false and misleading ESG statements to investors. BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager, has been hit with a first-of-its-kind cease and desist order and threat of massive fines regarding its alleged false and misleading statements to investors regarding the environmental, social, and governance, ESG, practices. On Wednesday, Mississippi Secretary of State Michael Watson and the Securities Division of the Secretary of State's office issued a summary cease and desist order and notice of intent to impose administrative penalty against BlackRock, Inc. According to the order, was issued in the public interest and for the protection of investors because BlackRock is violating provisions of the Mississippi Securities Act, The securities division is seeking to stop BlackRock's alleged fraudulent actions and impose a multi-million-dollar administrative penalty, a press release from the Secretary of State's office explains. BlackRock has recently asserted itself as a leader in the investment industry to promote environmental, social, and governance, ESG for you liberals listening, factors on portfolio companies. The securities division alleges BlackRock, through its ESG assertions, has repeatedly made false and misleading statements to Mississippi investors. These misrepresentations pertain to BlackRock's involvement in pushing ESG factors on portfolio companies. The company is also cited for omitting important facts regarding its investments as they pertain to ESG in statements to investors. BlackRock is duping investors into thinking its non-ESG funds aren't driven by ESG criteria and is also falsely leading investors to believe its ESG funds maximize profits, the order says. BlackRock made untrue statements that certain of its funds do not incorporate ESG considerations as detailed extensively in this order. BlackRock stated on multiple occasions, each expressly through publications or by action, that the company does in fact incorporate ESG considerations into its non-ESG funds. Indeed, BlackRock CEO Larry Fink has admitted that the term ESG is so toxic that he won't say it anymore because when people hear the term, we lose the conversation. Instead, BlackRock appears to have resorted to more surreptitious means of using its clients' money to further its ESG agenda. Many of BlackRock's acts, practices, and courses of business operate or would operate as a fraud or deceit upon investors and potential investors in Mississippi, the cease and desist order says. Each material representation, omission, fraud, or deceit upon another person in violation of the state securities will be treated as a separate offense. The securities division has already uncovered thousands of potential violations, each of which carries a $25,000 penalty, and will continue to look for more.
Chongo.
Last story. I've kept these for quite a while, so last little bit here. McKinsey, Diversity Matters, Delivers, Wins, Result, Revisited by Jeremiah Green and John R. M. Hand. In a series of very influential studies, McKinsey 2015, 18, 2020, and 2023 reports finding statistically significant positive relations between the industry-adjusted earnings before interest and tax margins of global McKinsey-chosen sets of large public firms and the racial ethnic diversity of their executives. However, when we revisit McKinsey's test using data for firms in the public observable S&P 500 as of 12/31/2019, we do not find statistically significant relations between McKinsey's inverse normalized Herfindahl-Hirschman resources of executive racial ethnic diversity at mid-2020 and either industry-adjusted earnings before interest and tax margins or industry-adjusted sales growth, gross margin, return of assets, return of equity, and total shareholder return over the period 5 years, 2015 to 19, combined with the erroneous reverse causality nature of McKinsey's test, our inability to quasi-replicate their results suggests that despite the imprimatur given to McKinsey's studies, they should not be relied on to support the view that U.S. publicly traded firms can expect to deliver improved financial performance if they increase the racial ethnic diversity of their executives.
Oh, man.
There you go. Stay tuned for my thoughts of the week.
Sing a song.
All right, time for my quotes of the day. But before I share, I want to remind everyone to subscribe to heartlandjournal.com. Go there and give us your email and zip, and we'll deliver news right to your inbox. I just got mine today, and that news is on fuego. So you're going to want to see that. Pretty cool. And I really hope you like it. And of course, follow us on at Heartland Journal on Twitter. McCormick McCarthy wrote a book called Sutree, S-U-T-T-R-E-E, Sutree, considered around the downtown slash river area of Knoxville in 1951. The imagery is unreal. I don't mean that in a pretty flowers kind of way. It was pretty raw, but fantastic nonetheless. I still can't drive around there without seeing a lot of the things and characters he wrote so graphically about. A Death in the Family by James Agee is also Knoxville-centric. a local guy, Jack Neely, wrote some great books called The Secret History of Knoxville that are worth checking out too. There's a downtown bar called Sioux Trees too. Number one, this is all about Knoxville. Welcome to K-Town. K-Town might be the exact same number of syllables as Knoxville, but that doesn't stop everyone from using the nickname anyway. And even though you'll find marketing slogans that try to push the name Knox, no one actually says that. Number two, orange is the only color that matters. There's no hiding Vols pride here in Knoxville, considering that the UT shade of orange is damn near retina burning. Be prepared to get rid of everything in your closet that doesn't go with orange. Number three, Knoxville is a college town through and through. Knoxville is a fairly big city, but make no mistake about it, the University of Tennessee's reach stretches to every corner. For every chain restaurant here, there's a trendy bar filled with a younger, hip crowd next door. Number four, things are pretty low-key here until game day. You know how whenever the cat in the hat shows up in a Dr. Seuss book, things go from reserved and calm and collected to the most fantastic mayhem imaginable? That's Knoxville on game day. Number five, you're welcome for Peyton Manning world. There's a quarterback out there. You may have heard of him, Peyton Manning. Yeah, no big deal or anything, but he was a volunteer. Number six, the giant painted rock in Knoxville's Statue of Liberty. Find the giant rock and you'll see that it spray painted something different all the time. Sometimes it's basic and sometimes it's a true work of art, but it's almost always pro Vols. Number seven, Smoke the Hound is everyone's hero. Smokey, sorry. Why is the Vols mascot a hound dog? The only answer to that question is a simple, because he wants to be a hound dog. Go Vols. That's it for this episode. Thank you, Michael Yaffe, for keeping talk radio conservatism alive. Lord knows, with George Soros buying up the podcast and radio platforms and Hispanic radio, we aren't long for this medium. God bless Cumulus for now. This is Goodbye. I am your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of HeartlandJournal.com. See y'all Thursday. Peace in our time, and definitely glory to God. Yeah, I've been dreaming of the
any views or opinions represented on the podcast are personal and belong solely to the creator and do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations that the creator may or may not be associated with in a professional or personal capacity unless explicitly stated.